Style and purpose. When browsing the modern newsstand, these two words aren't necessarily found within the same magazine. But as Yves Saint Laurent once told Andy Warhol, fashions fade, style is eternal. We'll peel open the pages of a title that lives and breathes that philosophy today on The Stack. From the Dory House in London, this is The Stack here on Monocle 24, 30 minutes of print industry analysis and lots of beautiful things on paper. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up a little later, we'll find out how our friends at the New York Times are balancing today's tense news climate with a softer approach in the pages of the New York Times Magazine.
The reading public is engaged in a pretty profound way, and that makes all of us feel like the work that we're doing is important and vital, and we feel a sense of pressure to get things right and to kind of rise to the occasion.
But first, for a long time, it felt as though most women's magazines were cut from the same old cloth. Today, however, the number of titles on the newsstand aiming to flip genre assumptions is growing at an encouraging rate, and many of them would no doubt count The Gentlewoman among their aspirations. Penny Martin is the Gentlewoman's editor, and she joins me now in studio. How have you been?
Great. I'm just back.
You're looking
fashion
great.
Week. Thank you. This is a great period in the season for us. Once we've done Fashion Week and we're just starting to make the magazine, I think sometimes when it's in its idea form, it's at the most sort of delicious stage. Of course, what I think it will be come September is a completely different thing from what I think at this point. And I think that's actually quite a kind of valuable stage where you come up with a kind of idea of the magazine and then it actually gets revised into something else. So I really find this point in the season great.
Well, we don't have a dedicated fashion program, so give us the Gentlewoman's house view, at least so far. How was the tour across New York, Paris, Milan, and perhaps elsewhere?
Well, I've seen it written up as kind of some curiously diverse season, as if that's strange. It didn't strike me as more diverse than usual. There's a lot of energy returned to certain aspects of fashion, and certainly Italy feels a bit more buoyant than it did a couple of years ago, and there's a lot of change over. I think the kind of most parroted wisdom is about this idea that the tenure in the big houses that used to be the kind of job for life has diminished such that almost people are losing patience and maybe even interest in who's got the big jobs. And I read in a Kathy Horan review at one point that really struck me when she said that it was the first time she'd been in Paris and in the Castiglione, and the bar tenders weren't asking who was going to be the new designer at Dior, as if they weren't even remotely interested. I think this was last season, and I think that will be a real pity. So I think all eyes are on these young designers like Vetements, etc., and it feels a little bit of a diversion from the big discussion.
And do you think that's just the ongoing corporatization that we see within all of these, and we're largely talking about the big groups, that they start to behave in the same way they would with any other executive?
Well, it's hard to know without actually working in one of them, but that's certainly what people are saying. I mean, there's a lot of kind of hope in some of the new transitions. I think everybody was very excited to see what Raf Simons did at Calvin Klein. It'll be very interesting to see what's happening, because even the image is very different, and the way that they're using paintings, etc., and it seems very clever, the kind of comms, etc. So you know, everybody kind of crossing their fingers. Certainly this whole buy now, see now, wear now, whatever idea feels a little bit like it was a flash in the pan, and already we're seeing people like Tom Ford, etc., kind of stepping away from their commitment to that. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens, because a lot of big companies, say like the Topshops, etc., have hitched their wagons to that.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question. You really do feel that the energy has gone from that. I mean, it never seemed like a sustainable idea. And for those listeners who are not close enough to the industry, we're really talking about major houses were saying that what you saw that day would be in the shops in X, which is taking a massive punt on, just your inventory. And you know, so anyone would have to look at that and say, I mean, you really have to believe in it. And then, of course, what does it do for the broader wholesale chain? It was already a very complicated idea.
Yeah, and I don't think that even the media have quite absorbed or understood it, and especially when some of the big brands, who shall remain nameless, are still asking you to come in 2 or 3 months ahead of their presentation so that you have had lead time to see the collections. Mm. It's just you saw it in private. It just means that it undermines the kind of function of the show, and the show becomes much more a press activity or for your customers ahead of the night when they actually buy, rather than this idea that it was to serve the industry to see the collections and then they would mediate them. It just means that the brands are in much more control of the imaging of their collections than they ever were.
Yeah, I want to jump back to Milan for a second because, of course, it's Salone next week and the design world, great and good, will be descending on Milan. You said that there was seemed to be just a different energy there. And you know, we've been thinking about that as well, that there is a bit of an afterglow. Oftentimes when an expo leaves town, it's gone for good. But I think it seems that the government of Milan, you know, they spent wisely. You really saw that it wasn't just something that, you know, happened between, you know, the edges of town and sort of the greater Fiera beyond. But there was a real investment in infrastructure as well in the city. You can see sort of that there were tangible changes. And do you think that there's... that's also part of the energy, a little bit of expo afterglow and just maybe a Northern Italian confidence that we haven't seen in the same way over the past few years.
Well, one of the first things that I ever noticed when I first started going to Milan, which wasn't very long ago, really, 10 years ago or something, that it just didn't feel like a young person's city. And I think that what I've noticed in the last year or two is there are many more things to do for, culturally, I try and imagine myself as a teenager or 20-something and kind of think, well, what do they do at the weekends? And were I living there, I would be so grateful for the Prada Foundation and the Bicocca and all of those kinds of things. And you, I think you see more people out running and there's just kind of more of a sense of actually visibly, people are visible in that age. And also, I think I always wonder about brands, say, like the Max Maras of this world, who surely are the companies that make clothing for working women. Hitherto, it felt like I never saw those women. But I think because of those cultural institutions, I'm starting to see how they live and what they wear, etc. So it almost feels a little bit like maybe Paris did around the time when, say, Colette was first formed. And you got this sense of this kind of 20, 30-something creative coming out into the public eye in a way that they never were. That may be my kind of privileged fashion magazine editor and kind of fashion show goer and view on things. But I think I have noticed a transition. It's interesting to hear that you have too.
Yeah, and I'm also wondering how many of those people that we're out seeing running, I'm not saying that people, that Milanese or people from Lombardia don't run, but also how many of them are from elsewhere within the EU or even further afield. And I think there's an internationalization going. And not to, you know, maybe capitalize off the back of the Article 50 being invoked earlier in the week, but is it becoming an alternative to London? People who might have come to London before, there are so many studios, there's so much production going on there that maybe it wasn't an option before, but this is, oh, it's a little bit more affordable. The mountains are there, the sea's not far away. And I wonder if we're starting to see that same bubbling up like we're seeing in Lisbon, like we're seeing in Amsterdam, and maybe Milan is also benefiting there.
Well, it's an interesting sort of dinner party provocation, isn't it? I think 5 years ago I would have said, oh God, no.
No, absolutely, no.
But hearing you ask those questions now, I think, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, there's Berlin and I can imagine that it's much more attractive to be offered a job in Milan at this moment. And you know, there's also interesting things happening. Riccardo's going to Versace. That suggests a whole new set of designers coming to town, and it's a small enough city to really feel the impact of something like that.
Yeah, and as I said, there is a quality of life to it, and you know, people complain about the fumes and everything else in Milan, but you know, you get that in any big city. But I think, yeah, I don't know, there is something going on, and that's a whole other program that we can do another day. we'll come back to Fantastic Man because it's just hit newsstands, certainly in this town, but I'm sure because it is printed on the continent, it's probably on newsstands very handsomely elsewhere on the continent already as well.
North Europe, certainly, on Thursday.
But should we start in Kassel, maybe? You have a beautiful little document a lovely journal in front of you. And tell us why we have this title on the table today.
Well, I brought along South is a State of Mind, which was actually a recommendation from our art director, Veronica Ditting. I think it would have come into her office because it's a Mavis and Van Dersen production, and they're the designers of it. And of course, Linda Van Dersen teaches at the Rietveld Academy, where Veronica studied, and also Jot van Bennekom, our creative director, taught at one point and have close connections. But it's that kind of school of Dutch and German graphic design. But it's just an extremely beautifully produced magazine, which existed beforehand, but I think it's become the temporary catalogue for the forthcoming Documenta, which opens in April in Greece and then in Kassel in June. It's quite a sort of politicised text, and it's got some really fantastic layered, as you would expect, graphic design. I mean, it's quite uncompromising, as those Dutch graphic designers are, but then I've kind of got used to that culture in our office.
I was going to say.
Very beautifully printed.
Just, I want to jump on the politicization. What stands out specifically that punctuates it?
Well, the editor's letter is quite provocative, and it's obviously trying to come to terms with kind of Europe as an idea. Clearly, opening in Kassel at that time, after what's happening in Europe, as you mentioned, this week and presumably ongoing, it's just trying to kind of decide what are the key issues of kind of, and be as open and human as it possibly can. I haven't pored over it in great detail yet, but certainly it's promises to be an extremely good festival, I think. I'm going to try and go if I can.
And it's just interesting as well, I mean, purely from a politicization point of view, that it starts in Greece and jumps to Germany alone, and then obviously sitting in Kassel at the heart of it all. And you know, and amidst all of it, as you said, of course, an election ahead, not too far off, at least at this point in Germany.
Indeed, indeed. I holidayed in Greece last summer, and we're working on something for the forthcoming issue of The Gentlewoman in September, if I'm not giving too much away, that is to do with, I guess, trying to create a kind of sustainable model to live and work in Greece at the moment. We've met a very interesting woman that we're working with. But yeah, it's actually an area that's quite new to me, and I'm hoping to kind of seed that into the issue a little bit more with the help of Documenta, fingers crossed.
And not giving too much away, but certainly I hadn't spent a lot of time in Greece and was in Athens last year, and I was really surprised by the amount of manufacturing there and really interesting things happening, whether it's footwear, accessories, and saw some, some really interesting brands which have this, you could say, almost an Athenian style to them, and living in a bubble. And whether these are young designers who are just happy to sell their collection in Mykonos to, of course, the Greek audience and those people who are there for the summer, and that's kind of it. But I was really impressed by Athens and what was going on, despite, of course, you know, you get down to Piraeus and all, you know, all of the ongoing problems that you have with border issues and just Greece struggling at that end of the Mediterranean, but a really interesting, healthy streak, creativity.
Well, I was out in the Cyclades, and so obviously it was a slightly different experience, but I certainly, one doesn't want to be glib about people's circumstances. I mean, it's extraordinary what they're having to overcome, but of course, it's amazing to experience the energy of people that are having to be so entrepreneurial in the true sense of the word. And, you know, that it was, dare I say it, really exciting to meet those people that were making it work. Because, God, you know, we think we've got problems.
Absolutely. I want to, we'll wrap up on the current issue of The Gentlewoman, but let's talk a little bit about Fantastic Man. A couple of things that stand out as highlights for you.
Well, of course, I didn't work on this issue. I've got something in it, and actually it remains a bit of a secret to me until it comes out. I hear little things getting floated around our office, but because we're now on two different premises...
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I was wondering how... I'm sure because probably lots of people who follow both titles probably think, oh, well, yeah, Penny's on one side of the office and she can see the wall going up and she hears what's being commissioned, but it's not the case.
I guess figuratively speaking, there's a little bit of that, and we sort of circle each other. But they're down in Holborn and we're up in Russell Square. So, of course, we're in and around each other. And then there's quite a lot that still goes on in Amsterdam. But yeah, I knew that Steve McQueen was going to be on the cover because I asked him. He lives around his mother lives around the corner from me. And I interviewed Woody Harrelson for this issue. So that was a great deal of fun for me. But no, I love that because they come out a month, 6 weeks after us. So it's a different conversation. Of course, there's sort of shared values. But because we've now got different design teams and different editorial teams, we sometimes find that we're using the same language. And, you know, Gert and Jopper in both publications, of course. But it's similar and yet different. So I like to remain a kind of reader of Fantastic Man and not think I'm kind of on the team. It
right, that yeah. So when it sort of hits the desk, oh well, I might bring it home at some point, but you're engaged and you're a consumer.
Yeah, and I was always the super fan before The Gentlewoman even existed.
Right.
So
tell us about this issue. We have Miss Coppola is on the cover.
Yeah, she's got a new film out in
and looking
June.
Yeah, looking brilliant.
It's a very
at the other end of the lens of Inez and Vinod, but really she's become very womanly.
Yeah, well, she's famously quite a sort of guarded interviewee, understandably. She's got a big family history there and a lot of people's stories to be protective of.
And great to see Holly Brubeck.
I was just going to say, if you set Holly Brubeck on the commission, then you get the information. So yeah, she was dogged in interviewing Sofia Coppola several times and went down to the set and met all the actors and was able to talk to the family a little bit. So we've got a really interesting story about her kind of thinking about, also just trying to respond to to what she's known for. She knows she's responsible for all these films that people see as kind of winsome and perhaps rather fey, and she's now sort of biting off with the Beguiler remake of a really gritty, quite hard-going storyline. And then who else have we got in there? We've got Nicola Sturgeon and Phoebe Waller-Bridge, the comedy writer and actor, which was kind of... I love doing humour in a women's magazine. I think it's really important, considering the kind of Hitchens line on women not being funny and on and all. And Pam Hogg, the Scottish fashion designer. There's a great wardrobe story with her. So there's kind of a lot of really great, strong women. And I think that now that Veronica Dittinger, our art director, lives in the UK, I think the fashion is a bit more evolved because we're able to work on it a bit longer than we previously were when we were in different countries. So I think that that's always stepping up a notch. And she's very good at finding sort of new photographers and working with kind of young ones, etc. So a lot of the people that we've been working for a while are really coming into becoming much more established practitioners. People like Zoe Gartner. She works a lot with Oliver Hadley-Perch and Lena Emery and many others. So, you know, Veronica and I are able to work a lot more intimately. And I think that's a working partnership I really enjoy, get a lot from.
I'm curious about also the split in office. I have to go back to that for a second. Is that just siblings growing up and having to move out from each other?
Practically, yes. But the desire is always to have a kind of, well, I suppose what you enjoy here, which is like a kind of integrated super office. Practically, it's difficult. But I think that is the dream.
Right.
So, yes, property developers, take notes. We're in the market for an office.
Yeah, the good news is I saw earlier in the week that there was an announcement that property prices in London, this is according, I think, to Morgan Stanley, are going to drop by over a third for office rents, which
is great news.
Amid, so, you know, not a lot of great news, but yeah. So anyway, indeed, any developers or landlords who are looking for the gentlewoman and fantastic man super office, you know who to call. Just before we go, state of the market, not just looking at your own title and your sibling title, but how are you feeling about the state of industry? And because you've got a very, very healthy spring issue in terms of advertising lineup, no question. I mean, it seems to be always the case for you. But yeah, just general mood.
We're in pretty good shape. Our last issue, our autumn winter issue, set new records for us, but everybody has taken with the spring issue you expect something a little bit less, and you know we're steady, but I can't report growth in this installment, but that's a very, very healthy picture in comparison with a lot of other women's magazines. I know a lot of people are really struggling. And the men's market, of course, is uncertain because the whole structure of the men's shows has changed. And a lot of people have held back advertising, waiting to see whether they're going to integrate their women's and men's presentation, etc. And therefore, will that mean that their advertising will be combined? There's certainly a lot of brands like Gucci and so on that are combining the imaging of men and women's whilst still
buying
in both. But it's very, very uncertain for a lot of magazines. I don't like to sound too cocksure in that, you know, we're doing fine, but I accept that the industry is up against it. Where there's a lot of opportunity for magazines like us, and certainly what we've been experiencing with the club, is that people want to work with us in a lot of different other ways. So in terms of events and collaborations and festivals, and we did something with Prada in Milan, those kinds of projects are still on the table. Certainly for us, it just requires a very small team to be very judicious with how we spend our time. And, you know, like yourselves, you know, we were quite sceptical about what return on an investment in online would pay off for us. And that's where we put what resources we have in terms of staff time, etc. And I've been really grateful for that, because actually, in terms of the team, I think the team is much more nourished by those kinds of activities often than just kind of throwing a version of our magazine down the digital well. However, I think that we know the way we've been able to use the web platform is to kind of image and represent those kinds of activities. And I think that's been a lot more, there's been a bigger return on that for us. But and also personally, having run a website, I think that, you know, I want to meet people in real time, and I feel that kind of commitment to the real is something that we're seeing right across culture, whether it's, you know, Wolfgang Tillmans' show, etc., or, you know, people turning up for political marches. That just kind of commitment to kind of time and space is really important and luxurious for us, at least.
Penny Martin, of The Gentleman, who knew that we would, when we grew up and we thought about being journalists, that we'd actually end up being event planners. But anyway, but here we
party
are.
Party goers.
Exactly.
Well, I think I did.
You're listening to The Stag here on Monocle 24. Going away for a very short break. When we come back, heading off to The New York Times. You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Burley. It's very nice talking to Penny Martin. Haven't seen her for ages. Anyway, let's jump across the Atlantic right now. Where would you guess that the first photograph in the New York Times was printed? On the front page? No. It's believed that the very first photograph actually appeared inside the pages of the New York Times magazine, first published in 1896. The magazine was positioned as a serious countervoice to the piles of fluffy fare offered by other weekend publishers of the early 20th century, and it's often credited with saving the Times from ruin. The magazine's editor, Jake Silverstein, spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about what to expect in the upcoming issue.
There's a very interesting story that the readers may find of particular interest at the moment about the British writer and activist Majid Nawaz, who's some of your listeners are familiar with him. He's a founder of an organization called the Quilliam Foundation that seeks to eradicate Islamic extremism in the world. And what's notable about Nawaz is that he himself is a former extremist, having spent a little bit of time in prison for his relationship with the Islamic Revolutionary Organization in the early 2000s. And so he's got a kind of an interesting perspective as somebody who has felt the lure of radical extremism and is now in a position of trying to explain why others might feel that way and what can be done to counteract it. That's quite an interesting piece.
How is it to be the editor of the magazine in such a politically charged moment in the U.S.?
Well, of course, this is a great time for all different kinds of media, whether you're working at a magazine, a newspaper, a television news station. There is just so much interest in the news right now. The New York Times has seen its subscriptions grow by leaps and bounds, and whatever your measurement you're taking is, it's just clear that the reading public is engaged in a pretty profound way. And I think that makes all of us feel like the work that we're doing is important and vital, and we feel a sense of pressure to get things right and to kind of rise to the occasion. And that's always a good feeling, really. I mean, you want to be doing important work. The interesting quality for us at the New York Times Magazine that's a little different perhaps from other magazines is, or at least other magazines in the United States, is that there aren't too many magazines that are like ours, that are sort of serious general interest titles that are supplements of a newspaper. So most of the magazines that we consider our peers are magazines that are standalone newsstand magazines, such as The New Yorker or The Atlantic. And unlike those magazines, we're connected to a newsroom that's covering the events in Washington and around the world every single day. And that doesn't mean that we don't consider it our job to also cover those things, but we sort of do it in balance with a Washington bureau that is second to none.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. How do you find the balance? Because, you know, as a follower of your magazine, you do make some quite interesting features, about politics in the U.S. or even abroad as well, with some kind of lighter tones as well. Like, for example, I love the issue about the 25 songs that tell us where music is going. I think it's always such a joy as well.
I mean, to me, it's a great joy to be the editor of a general interest magazine, because versatility, flexibility, having something to say on a range of topics, I mean, that's just great fun to be in that position and to get to work on so many different kinds of stories and different subjects and, different kinds of writers and photographers and illustrators and artists as well. It's a great joy, and we feel very lucky to have such a wide range of movement that we get to undertake every week. And we definitely think about how the magazine will relate to the overall reading experience of the New York Times. So, when we publish an issue like the music issue, the one you just mentioned, 25 songs that show us where music is going, we know that that's going to be a bit of a break for the reader who's opening up the Sunday paper and reading through a lot of pretty serious news in the front section, probably about Trump or, world events, and that they're going to get to the magazine and it's going to be a little break. And sometimes that's great. Sometimes that's a perfect role for us to play. Of course, that doesn't mean that we this coming weekend we have a major story about Donald Trump on the cover and his legislative path forward after the failure of the healthcare law last week. So we, by no means do we consider our role to be providing a kind of respite from the serious news and the rest of the paper. We like to mix it up. And when we do the longer stories, the question that we're always asking, when we do the more serious stories, which is, I think, the majority of what we do, honestly, we are always trying to figure out what distinguishes a story in the magazine about Donald Trump from a story in the newspaper about Donald Trump, of which there are, of course, many.
I did look at the latest cover, and again, it's impressive as usual, you know, the design. I was thinking about it. Do you think you can allow yourself to be a little bit more even experimental with the covers because of the fact that you're, you know, a supplement of a newspaper? So, you know, people don't grab it just because of the cover. So you allow yourself certain liberties that you wouldn't on a normal weekly without a newspaper.
100% agree with what you just said. And I actually think it's one of the opportunities for this magazine. Again, I mean, I recognize that in Europe, there are more magazines that are serious, that are supplements of newspapers, but there aren't that many in the United States. And so for us in our environment, the fact that we are not on the newsstand, that we come with the newspaper, that's a huge opportunity. And one of the things we've really tried to do over the last few years is take that opportunity and use it. And the way we try to use it, or the way we sort of interpret what the opportunity is that, you know, we have a huge amount of freedom, and that should be an invitation for us to be experimental on the cover, to be very design forward in the way we think, to challenge people, to do stuff that's beautiful. Of course, we want readers to hold on to our covers and put them on the news, on the coffee table, and enjoy them as works of art, but also to do stuff that will be provocative and change people's perceptions about what a magazine cover can do. And certainly we are free of the obligation that we would have if we were on the newsstand of having to, in a straightforward way, sell the issue. And that's just a huge gift for us.
Jake, I'm curious about something. Another very successful publication from the New York Times is, of course, T Magazine. What's your relationship with the team? Because it seems to me that, you know, it's also, you know, coming out in the newsstands more frequently than in the past. That's at least my perception.
No, it's about the same as it has been. Although, if that's your perception, that's probably a good sign, right? It means it, you know, it's top of mind for you. We don't have that much of a formal relationship. I mean, our staffs are seated close to each other in the building, and we are all quite friendly, and we share some writers, and we certainly share some information, and occasionally we'll kind of put our shoulders to the wheel together to help on something. But for the most part, the magazines operate pretty independent of each other.
And finally, Jake, which other magazines do you look for, you know, perhaps inspiration, or just when, you know, when you want to relax on a Sunday afternoon, which magazine do you pick it up to read?
Well, like a lot of people here in the States, I read The New Yorker religiously. It's one of the great magazines in the country, and we're often covering some of the same stuff, so sometimes I'm reading it, you know, as a competitor, looking to see what they've got that we don't. The Atlantic has always been very interesting. New York Magazine, a perennial favorite. Harper's Magazine, others as well, but those are probably in the top of the kind of things I regularly go to. I don't read German, so I can't really read it, but I always look at Zeit Magazine for the design, which I find quite interesting.
That was Jake Silverstein, editor of the New York Times Magazine. He was talking to our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco. This is The Stack. And that's all for this week's edition of the program. Fernando was our producer today alongside Ben Ryland, and our editors were Claire Urban and Toby Hammond. If you have any comments or queries, do drop us a note to FP, that's Fernando Pacheco, of course, at monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes. Of course, you can also hear more about our upcoming Quality of Life conference in Berlin, which should probably have an interesting buffet of very good media people, and that's going to be happening in late June in the German capital. Of course, if you fancy buying some magazine titles mentioned on The Stack, do pay a visit to the Kiosk Cafe, Monocle's very own newsstand in Paddington here in London. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tyler Brulé. Until next time, it's goodbye for me.